What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast, SEA, A Story of Survival. Today, we're talking with John Mays, athletic trainer at A. Leif Hastings High School, where he's talking about an incident where they had sudden cardiac arrest. And just in our pre-conversation, John was also telling me that he's dealt with death six different times as an athletic trainer at Prairie View A&M and some very serious issues with his own daughter. And so he's going to share some of those and he's going to tell the story of how they provided care, how they helped that athlete survive. He's also going to tell some of the stories of how he's dealt with losing four athletes to a car wreck and discussing with the parents. He's going to tell the story of how he had to deal with his own daughter being in a car wreck and him not being able to help. And then how he helped his coworkers and himself deal with all the trauma and the aftermath of performing CPR and using an AED on an athlete and them surviving. So he's going to tell his story and then how he's processed all of that. So this episode is sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/John Mays, and that's M-A-Y-E-S. Again, this is sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/John, J-O-H-N-M-A-Y-E-S, John Mays. All right, John, welcome to the show. And I want to start off, why don't you tell me your athletic trainer story? So where did you get started and where have you been?
Wow. It's been a journey, but, you know, I've enjoyed the journey. I first started in high school, back at MC Williams High School. And the reason I got engaged in athletic training, it was sort of kind of a roundabout way, but my brother played football. And I remember Coach Ezell Seals, which is a coach here in the area, he said, "Hey, I want you to be my trainer." And I didn't know what a trainer was, but the thing is that I was in charge of keeping up with the footballs. So not because my brother played, but as I grew up and I started playing sports and stuff like that, and, you know, I always had a lot of friends that played football. And, you know, and until football practice was over, you know, that wasn't really anybody on my street in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
You know, to actually, you know, engage in the afternoon if I wanted to play a game of pickup basketball. So Coach Seals remembered me and Coach George Dearborn and Coach Baker. And the good thing about it, all of these coaches, you know, they knew me, they knew my parents, you know, and they kind of like grew up in the neighborhood themselves. So what happened was Coach Dearborn said, I said, "Well, Coach, I want to get a job because I wanted to get a car." And he told me, "Well, you're not going to quit basketball to just because you get a job and you want a car." He said, "You're going to be a trainer." I said, "Trainer? I'm not being no trainer." You know, so to make a long story short, I remember coming home one day and Coach Baker, which grew up down the street, I saw him in the driveway talking to my dad. And I guess he told my dad that I had quit. And so I knew it was something going on because the look that my dad had, it was like, "Hey, we got to talk." Mm-hmm. But anyhow, I'm grateful and I'm thankful for people that were around me that cared enough about me, you know. And basically, that's how I got started. And so I started hanging out and stuff like that. And I remember meeting Logan Wood at Del Mar Stadium. And what happened was the coach used to always give me his car, and I would take the athletes over there to get treatments at Del Mar during our sixth period athletics. So what happened, Logan and I, we became friends, and I would always ask a lot of questions. And he'd call me Toothpick. He said, "Toothpick, you sure do ask a lot of questions." And I was just saying, "Hey, you know." And so normally at the football games, Logan would always be there. And eventually he told me, he said, "Hey, what are you doing? I want you to learn how to tape." And so I had a couple of athletes I took over there. So he gave me a roll of tape and told me to tear it, and I couldn't. I'm like, "You can't tear this stuff. You need..." He said, "You can," and he tore it. And I remember the influence that he had. He had a couple of workshops that I went to, and the rest was history. And the thing was, when I became a senior, he asked me, he said, "What are you going to do?" And I said, "I don't know. I'll probably maybe perhaps go to the military." And he said, "To the military?" He said, "You ever thought about, you know, being a student athletic trainer?" I said, "Student trainer?" He said, "Yeah, you can get a scholarship." So what he did, he picked up the phone, and I was in his office, and Logan called out to Houston Baptist and talked with a guy he called Fluff. His name was Vernon Ashenfelder. And I went out and met him, and Brennan said, hey, I want you to come out and be a part of the program. But being back then, you know, it was somewhat of a culture shock to me, you know, coming from the north side of town and then going over there to the southwest side. It was a little bit different going to a Christian school, even though I came up in a Christian home. But then I looked around. I said, hey, I didn't really see anybody that looked like me, you know. So I'm like, hey, this might not be the place for me. But Vernon Ashenfelder, he was real understanding when I told him that I decided I wasn't going to come to HBU. And then Logan told me, he said, do you know John Harvey? I'm like, John Harvey? I don't know John Harvey. So he picked up the phone and called over to Texas Southern. And I went over there with the legendary John Harvey and became a student trainer. And that was the beginning of my career.
All right. So after TSU, what was next?
Well, when I after I finished TSU, I still had that military thought in my head. I wanted to go into the military. But my brother, he fought in Vietnam, and he came back with some issues. So my mom, she said, I don't want you to go to the military. But I'm like, hey, I'm going to go to the military. I'd already talked to a recruiter, and he was making it really sound good. But after I thought about it, I didn't want to do anything to hurt my mother. And my dad, he served in the armed services. And my brother, you know, because of the way the Vietnam War was fought, I mean, he had some real emotional problems. Eventually, he returned to his old normal self. But I thought about it, and I said, no, I'm not going to do it. But what happened was one of my mentors, Frank Walters, he said, hey, John, he said, won't you come over here? And I said, well, I got to do my student teaching, and then I'll get my degree, I'll get my license. And he said, well, won't you come over here and see if you can student teach at Smiley? But I didn't student teach at Smiley. I did my student teaching at Forest Brook. And it just so happened, I said, hey, my uncle is the head football coach over there. It was Charlie Brown. So it made real good. So Frank and I became real good friends, even though I used to see him all the time over at Texas Southern visiting John Harvey. So when Frank left to become the trainer at Prairie View, then I graduated, then I became the head trainer at M.B. Smiley High School in North Forest ISD. And after about 10-year tenure there, I thought about, you know, what would the college level be like? So what I did, I applied at Prairie View. Of course, you know, Frank was at Prairie View, and then all of a sudden he said, hey, I'm leaving. Why don't you come to Prairie View? I'm going up to A&M to pursue my doctorate degree. He said, and I can't do both. I'm like, no, Frank, I don't think I won't want to do that. But to make a long story short, I end up at Prairie View in 1989 and up until 2011. That was my place of employment. And now I'm over in the A-Leaf Independent School District at Hastings High School. And after 22 years at Prairie View, and I've had some great memories and some also not so great memories, but through it all, you know, I can count it all as joy.
All right. So, A-Leaf, the specific incident where you were talking about, you kind of told the story at the G-Hats Awards banquet when you and I both received the G-Hats Off Award, which is for performing life-saving skills that we are sometimes required to use as athletic trainers. I've told the story several times before. Our athlete did not survive.
Wow.
But yours ended up surviving. So why don't you tell me a little bit about that story, and then we're going to talk about some of the other ones, some of the other times you've dealt with death as well.
Wow, that was really a scary situation. Yeah, it was during the Christmas holidays, and of course, we had two games going on at two different sites. We had a game in the South Gym and a game in the North Gym, which is probably maybe a city block apart. And it just so happened, you know, I was there covering the games, and of course I can't be in two places at one time. And I had received a call that someone had hurt their ankle over in the South Gym, so I left. So by the time I did the evaluation on the kid, I said, okay, we're going to get some ice and put on it. So I went to make an ice bag. Then all of a sudden, one of the basketball coach, I heard someone screaming my name down the hall. And I'm like, who is that? And when I looked out the training room door in the South Gym, I saw him running down the hall screaming, saying, "Doc, you need to come back to the North Gym." I'm like, "Hey, I just left there." You know, and then I saw a police officer come through the door. He said, "Hey, we need you in the North Gym." I said, "Okay, I'm on my way." No one actually at that time really told me what was going on. So when I got to the door, he said, "Hey, this guy's having a seizure or something." So I said, "Okay." So I think I handed the ice bag to somebody else. I don't really remember. But I left and I ran over to the North Gym. And when I got there, I just seen a circle of people on the floor. So when I got through the people and I ran over there and I saw one of the scorekeepers attempting to do CPR. So I immediately went and got the AED. And when I came back, I told her, I said, "I'll do the compression." But at that time, he was discharging fluid and blood all out of his mouth. And I really didn't know exactly what was going on. And then the assistant principal said, "You don't have a pulse." I said, "Okay, I'll do the compressions." And I began doing the compressions, and I said, "Put the pads on him, you know." And once we got the pads on him, and I said, "Do you have a pulse?" She said, "I got a pulse." I said, "Well, engage the AED." And then, of course, we had to hit him about three or four times. And, you know, it was no pulse, so we had to continue to do CPR until EMS got there. And once EMS got there, you know, they, of course, they incubated him and all that kind of stuff, started bagging him and you know, doing suction and CPR. And they worked on him another 15, 20 minutes even before they transported him, trying to really stabilize him. But it was a shock to me, you know. But I was saying, and as I was doing CPR, I remember myself saying, "Come on, son, come on, son." And I remember inadvertently saying, "Lord, help me, Lord, help me." And like I said, you know, God showed up and he showed out. And when people would ask me and say, "Wow, what happened? Were you afraid?" I said, you know, knowing that God is an able God, you know, the joy of the Lord is my strength. So long as I have his joy, then I have his strength. And unless you have joy, you can't have his strength. And I know beyond a shadow of a doubt, and I was telling him, I said, "Man, I hope and pray that the kid makes it." And I did. I said, "Lord, help him. Lord, you know, you're the one. You can do it. You can do it." And as I stood there and watched him load him in the ambulance and drive off, and then I said, "Well, coach, you know, we need to cancel the games. You know, we need to do something about this. It doesn't make sense, a situation like that we continue to play." But what I did, and he wasn't one of my kids. He was a kid from Austin High School. And what I did, I told my sports coordinator, Coach Martell, I said, "Look, coach, I'm going to leave. I'm going to the hospital because I want to know what was going on with this kid." And it just so happened that the kid survived. When he got there, his parents were there. And the parent walked up and she said, "Thank you. It's a good thing that you all had the AED and you all were there." You know, and it was kind of, you know, after I thought about it, I looked at it. I'm like, wow. I said, I was really placed in a position of compromise, being that I couldn't be in two places at one time. You know, and then I thought about it. I'm saying, wait a minute. You had coaches that were there, and they were standing looking. So it was, but, you know, to God be the glory, you know, and I always try to acknowledge, you know, God for his mercy and his grace, because that's all it was. It wasn't so much what I done, you know, because in the end, it was up to him. It was up to God to make that decision. But I'm grateful and I'm thankful that the kid made it, and he made a full recovery, and I'm just thankful.
Have you had any contact with him since then? I know you went to the hospital, but
no, I did talk with his coach, and I asked the coach about him, but I hadn't had any contact since maybe a couple of days after it happened, you know. But I remember, you know, having a conversation with State Representative Sylvester Turner, which is now Mayor Sylvester Turner, and regarding an EKG bill that they had in the House, you know, as far as adding it, making it a requirement that each kid have an EKG with their physical. And I just told him. He said, "Man, look," he said, "I think it was a guy out of Baytown, and him were one of the names on the bill." But I said, "That would be a great idea." He said, "Well, what do you think?" I said, "Well, I say, in my case, in my situation, where I am, a lot of the kids, you know, sometimes don't even see a doctor on a regular basis unless they're getting a physical to participate in sports." I said, "It would be great, you know, if it was mandatory that we have it." I said, "Because a lot of the problems that a lot of kids have can be detected, you know." But, you know, eventually I think it was passed. So I'm grateful for that.
All right. So how did you guys go about dealing with that? I mean, I know you said you were there kind of by yourself. So what was done to help you process all of that information of, you know, performing CPR and having to use the AED, using those life-saving skills?
I guess it was instinct, you know, being in this profession. And I tell the younger trainers all the time, I said, every time I run on the field to see about a kid, I said, I don't care what it is. I said, I'm nervous and I'm scared. I said, I'm just being honest. I said, if you're not nervous and you're not afraid, I remember a young athletic trainer told me, "Oh, it's no problem for me. That's when my skills kick in." It's easy said than done. You know, as athletic trainers, we, you know, in our profession, we're responsible for relieving pain and suffering. And if you're human, I mean, I feel for my athletes. I fear for my athletes, especially when it comes to them being injured, because they're going to look to me. And I tell them, if you're not nervous and somewhat afraid, and I'll always be thinking the worst. You know, so that helps me a lot in being prepared, you know, to do what I do as an athletic trainer.
All right. Just a quick shout out to the AT Cares program that's going to be starting up. I know at NATA Houston, they're going to have a training for the AT Cares program, and that's going to help people who are in my situation or your situation deal with the catastrophic injury or death. And so it'll be athletic trainers helping athletic trainers, because as Bub and I have talked so many times, you don't really want to speak with the school nurse or the school counselor who has no idea what it's like to be an athletic trainer, who doesn't know the athlete or isn't around them or around the other kids that are affected by it. And so if you know somebody going through this situation, send them, you know, get in contact with the AT Cares program through the NATA. Check that out. Just Google it, look on NATA, and find out there some more information about that. So, all right, John, you also mentioned some of the other times that you've dealt with death as an athletic trainer. Why don't you tell us some of those stories?
Wow. The one I can really recall right off the top of my head, and I see it as if I'm looking at it right now, was, I guess it was back in, matter of fact, it was in February. I think it might have been around 2000 or so, 2001. Members of our track team at Prairie View was involved in a terrible van accident on the way to Arkansas for an indoor track meet. And what happened was I had one of my student trainers that was accompanying the team, and I was getting ready to hit a 6-day, no, about a 5-day road trip with the basketball. So I had left campus, and I was on my way home, and my phone just kept blowing up. And I'm like, who is this? I didn't really realize the numbers. So I said, well, you know, they'll leave a message, because I'm trying to get home, get my clothes, and get back, you know, to get on the bus, to get on the road. So when I got home, I got a call, and it was from the president's office. And one of the president's assistants said, hey, you need to get back to the campus right now. The president, Hines, wants you back right now. So I'm saying, what happened? He said, there's been an accident, and we have 4 fatalities known and perhaps 2 more. I'm like, what? I'm thinking that, what fatalities? Is it on campus? Then they told me it was the track team. So what I did, I just did a turnaround. I didn't get any clothes. I went, drove right back to the campus and went to the president's office. And that's when I was informed about the accident. We had 4 student athletes that were killed. We had 2 that was seriously injured that required extensive long-term care. And I thank God right now that they're doing okay. And then we had others that had little bumps and bruises and cuts and stuff like that. Even the track coach, he was injured. But when we got back to the campus, you know, the president wanted myself and the chief of police to leave immediately and go to Marshall, Texas. But what we did, because it was so late, it was like, I want to say about 2 o'clock in the morning. We just waited. We called a flight, flew into Shreveport, and drove into Marshall. But when we got there, you know, that's when it really, really hit me. When I went to the hospital to see all the ones that were still alive and injured, and it, to see 2 of my athletes, one with a broken neck, and cuts, and all over, and one of them with multiple skull fractures and all swollen up, and I'm like, God. I know these kids. And then to walk out of the hospital in the waiting room and you see the parents. Then I look up and I see one of the parents of the deceased kids. And by us being representatives of the university, you know, I was like, what do I say? What can I say? You know, and she asked the question, what happened to my child? And I'm like, and I looked at Chief Stevens, the police chief, and I just answered. And then the other track coach, he came in, and he was finished speak. Then he broke down and started, you know, crying. So I engaged a parent, and then she was with her husband, and I was like, it appeared that I couldn't even create words to say. I didn't know what to say. You know, I wanted to say, well, you know, I'm sorry. I wanted to say everything's going to be all right. Then I wanted to say nothing. But instead, I just said a little prayer. And I'm like, wow. And through it all, and then we had to go to the morgue to positively identify the deceased, myself and the police chief, and that was terrible, you know. But so much for that, I see those kids just as plain as day right now. But I'll never forget that. And another incident that I had at Prairie View was a transfer football player from New Mexico. He came in, he wasn't in camp. Oh, I guess about 3 or 4 days, and we were doing acclimation and stuff, and he came out there, a really good-looking athlete, and we were running. And, of course, we had our water stations out there. We had our cows all over, so they were getting hydrated, and I used to call, I used to always set the beach up, you know. I'd have a big Rubbermaid, you know, tank full of ice, and I'd set ice chests of 20-ounce Gatorade so they can, you know, sit out there and just take recovery baths and drink Gatorade. But on that day, it was extremely hot. But and I saw the kid. The kid was running, and they were doing gases back across the field. And I looked at him. The first couple of them, he was looking real good. I mean, I was like, man, this guy's going to really help the team. And then I started talking to one of my GAs. And when I turned, he was saying, Doc, look. And I looked, and he was stumbling. And he fell. And the coach said, of course, he called his name. He said, get up, finish. So he got up again, took off, and he fell again. So when he fell, he rolled over, and he just grabbed his head. He was saying, my head. And right then, I think I grabbed a 10-gallon cooler. It was full of water that was on the back of my flatbed cart, and I just poured it on it. And I told one of my student trainers, I said, Anthony, get the cart. And I told the other one, I said, look, call the health center and tell them that we got one possible heat exhaustion and we're on our way. And within 5 minutes, but when I got to him, it was like his eyes were like baby doll, and he was just screaming in my head. So once we got him, we packed him down, cooled him off, we got him on the cart, we got him on over to the health center, and they had already prepped to start putting for IVs and stuff like that. So he was like, oh, he was just moaning, my head hurts. And so when Dr. Barry walked in, and he said, oh, you getting his temperature? He said, what? And then she said, and she told him that his temperature was 104 point something. And he said, call the ambulance. He got to get out of here. And we just dumped ice on him, packed ice on him, ran IVs in him. And then I told my GA, I said, look, you stay here. I'm going back to the field. And when I went back to the field, conditioning was over. And we started gathering everything up. So I got on my golf cart and was headed back to the training room. And I saw my GA running up the sidewalk toward me. And I'm like, and I stopped. I said, what's happening? She said, I thought I told you to go to the hospital with him and that I would come and get you after practice. She said he didn't go to the hospital. She said he's back on the back road. They're waiting for life flight because his heart stopped. They're doing CPR on him now. So by the time I hit the sidewalk and went around and went to the back of the campus, Life Flight was loading him up, and they took him off to the medical center to Herman. And when I got there, I mean, he was basically still in the same state. You know, they had incubated him, they had him on a ventilator, and he was like that for about 3 weeks. And I remember calling my athletic director, Mr. Charles McClellan, then at Prairie View, and I said, Charles, we've got a situation here. I said, I'm at the hospital, and we got a situation that don't look good. I said, we need to contact the kids' parents. I said, I don't have any information. I said, we need to find out what coach recruited him, you know, because he would be the one that had to deal with the parents. And so what happened was, it just so happened one of the coaches that recruited him was also his neighbor that grew up across the street from where his parents lived. And so I said, look, he said, well, what do you think we need to do? He said, well, I'll tell you what. He said, I'll be there in 30 minutes. So the athletic director came, and he said, well, I said, Charles, look. I said, we got a situation, and after just talking to the doctors, I said, it doesn't look good. I said, we need to get his parents down here. We need to get them down here today. He said, well, what do we need to do? I said, we need to get on the phone. I said, I get on the phone, and I talked to his mom and explained it that we got him here. And we'd like you to come. She said, well, you know, I can't come, you know, my husband. I said, well, we're going to arrange for your tickets. We'll arrange for you to be picked up at the airport and everything. So the AD, he got on and got his credit card and bought her tickets. And she flew in the next morning. I remember picking her up, and she was asking me all these questions. And I was saying, well, and I was trying to stay positive, you know, but somewhere in the back of my head, I was saying, it doesn't look good. And then, especially when one of the physicians, I overheard them, they were talking, they were saying, it seemed like a disconnect. It may be that his brain stem's burned up. I'm like, you know, he said, there's got to be a disconnect, you know. And it was like, it was nonchalantly saying, I'm like, wait a minute, what's going on here? So they end up taking him down and doing a scan, doing all that time. But when I went back, and I said, he said, well, yes, everything's set up. So, like I said, the next morning I picked up his mother from the airport, and she kept questioning me. And once again, I didn't know what to say. You know, I don't care how long you've been in this business of athletic training. There are going to be times that you're going to be confronted with things that you're not going to know what to say. And that's when you know, God's spirit, if you be quiet, he will speak for you. And it just so happened, you know, with that kid's mom, she was when she went in and she saw him, she just broke down. And she turned to me and she said, what happened to him? I said, well, he was running. She said, well, did he? No, he didn't get hit. He was just doing conditioning. I said, and he just passed out. And she didn't even know that he had sickle cell. It was found out doing the blood work at the hospital. And, you know, that was one of the major causes of his death. You know, but, you know, he stayed there for 3 weeks. And, you know, we did everything that we possibly can. But when it comes to your child and when it comes to death, you know, I don't care what you do or say, especially when you're dealing with a parent and that's their child. You know, you can't replace their kids. you know. And she stayed here for 3 weeks. The university did an excellent job in making sure that she was comfortable. You know, I even got my sister, who has a hair salon. I took her to the hair salon so she can be taken care of and all that. But the worst thing in the world, Jeremy, that I can think of is when we schedule him to be medevaced back home to Oklahoma. And when he got down there, because I remember his mom looked at me and she said, "Doc, I want to take my child home." And I was trying to convince her, saying, "Hey, you know, let him stay here. This is the best place for him." He was in Herman. I said, "It's the best trauma center, so we can try to sort things out." She said, "No, I want him home." And I told my AD, and I said, "You know, his mother, Miss Colson, she wants to take her son home." He said, "Well, get it done." He said, "If that's what she wants, then we'll get it done." So we set it all up and we sent him home, and he didn't last a week, Jeremy. He died. When I got the news, I was like, "Oh man, I can't deal with this anymore." It's like, I can't deal with this anymore. You know, so what happened, I wanted to go to the service, and then I said, "Well, no, I'm not going to go." Because I wanted to remember him as being that vibrant, good-looking offensive tackle sprinting across the field. And the following week after he expired, and mind you, he was the youngest of his family. He was the baby. And I remember getting a call from the coach that recruited him and said, "Hey, you're not going to believe this." Now, she just buried her child that Wednesday. Friday morning, her husband woke up and he dropped dead in the bedroom from a massive heart attack. So when I said, "Man, don't tell me that, coach." He said, "Yeah, man." He said, "That's what happened." He said, "I think it was his sister called him and told him that she was talking to her husband. She left out of the room and came back, and he just fell in the floor, and he had a heart attack." So that was, I mean, I was like, wow. And a lot of times you'll ask yourself the question, you know, if this hadn't happened, then that wouldn't have happened, you know. But but in our profession, you know, and I tell coaches all the time, you know, we are here. And a lot of coaches look at athletic trainers as being a necessary evil because a lot of coaches are driven by their ego, you know. And I tell the coaches, I'm saying, "Coaches, we're basically here to help and protect you, because a lot of you all can get out of your lane, you know." But they don't understand that, you know. And I know I make a lot of coaches upset, and they were saying, "Well, I've been coaching 40 years." I said, "Well, you can find a coach in a barbershop. Every barbershop you go in, you can always find a coach. Mm-hmm. Somebody's coaching." And I said, "How much is coaching? You know, how much really, what do you do? If you had 5 Michael Jordans on your team, you'd be stupid to try and coach them." You know, a lot of it's just raw talent. But, you know, I understand, you know, our purpose as allied healthcare professionals, you know. And I see a lot of, you know, even with my student trainers, I have some student trainers that were in athletic training that just got out. I said, "I'm not going to deal with those coaches, this, that, and the other." But you got to look past that and beyond that as an athletic trainer and say, "Why am I here? Why am I doing this?" You know, and always understand it's all about humility. It's about you caring for other people. You know, you serving a purpose. You know, by design, all of us, I don't care who you are, where you're from, what color you are, you are put here on earth by design to be a servant one to the other. And basically, as athletic trainers, that's what we are. We're allied healthcare professionals, but we are servants. You know, we facilitate all the needs of an athlete. Sometimes an athlete come in your training room don't necessarily need treatment. He just wants you to give him a word of encouragement. You know, he just want to just hear you say something positive to him that he can carry out. Or he may just want to just come in your training room just to vent to you, you know. So I think athletic trainers, we're the surrogate parent when it comes to the athletic programs. But, you know, as I first stated, you can never forget, or you can never, you know, get to the point as an athletic trainer where you can say, okay, I've experienced a death, and you can forget about it. That's not so.
Yep. And I want to, again, remind you that if you are an athletic trainer or a healthcare provider and you experience this, you're not alone. Obviously, there's two of us right here. I'm here. John has experienced it multiple times. He's also experienced the other side of that where they've used the life-saving skills and it's come out victorious there. So you're not alone. Reach out to somebody you know around you. And as we were talking with Jared Plummer, he said his greatest resource is his network. And as an athletic trainer, there's no way you don't know an athletic trainer because you were taught by athletic trainers. So reach out to your network. And then, John, you were saying we kind of become surrogate parents. And until you go through that experience, you don't really know what it's like to tell the parents your son is dead. Here's what happened. And John, you also shared a story before we started about your daughter, and you talked about the hopelessness of that.
Oh, wow. It was on May 28th. I think it was the Friday, Memorial Day weekend. My daughter, she was, I think they went to Top Golf or something like that. And some of her high school and college friends, they wanted to get together and stuff, and they were on their way home, and I got a call. Oh, I guess it was about, I would say about 1:15 in the morning. And when I got the call, I'm like, who is this calling me this late on my cell phone? So when I answered, and they told me, they said, well, it's been an accident, and, you know, Sidaria, your daughter, you know, I'm like, what? I said, where? So by the time, you know, I was real funky eyed, and it really registered me. That's when I got in a hurry. And of course, I'm thinking, oh my goodness. So I don't even think I had my driver's license. I just got my keys and I left. And when I got there, I seen all the lights and the fire trucks and ambulances, and I seen an overturned SUV on his roof. I'm like, man, and I couldn't get to it. So what I did, I just pulled off the freeway and I just ran down the freeway and ran across and jumped across the barrier. And when I got there, I was looking and I saw my daughter's friend, and she was bleeding, and one of the firemen had her, and she was bleeding from her head. And when that happened, I asked her, I said, hey, Aaron, and she turned and looked. I said, where's Sidaria? And she just pointed to the mangled up vehicle. So I'm looking at that, and I'm like, what? And as I began to try and approach the vehicle, the police officers and firemen was telling me to get back, because it was gas on the street. And I've never felt so helpless in my life. But it just so happened, my daughter heard my voice. And when she heard my voice, she screamed, Daddy, it hurts. Daddy, it hurts. So when I looked and I tried to reach, and it was almost like I couldn't move. I didn't know what to say. The police officer and fireman was telling me to get back. They was trying to pull the cable to the jaws of life to cut her out. And she screamed, Daddy, it hurts. So when I reached in and I touched her hand and I asked her to squeeze my hand, and she squeezed my hand, right then I just said a prayer. I said, Lord, I need you now. And of course, I started rehearsing all these things in my head all the time as an LA trainer. I've helped other people, kids, and here I am. I can't even help my own. But I always got help. And I told God right then, Lord, I need you now. And he came through. He showed up and he showed out. And when they got through cutting my daughter out of there and they put her in the ambulance, and I was just saying, Lord, help me. I needed help. And I got there, and of course they had her in X-ray, and you know she had some laceration and cuts on her, and when they came out and afterwards, they kept her and they let me see her, and she was crying. She said, Daddy, I hurt so bad. I said, well, don't cry. And then the doctor came in, and then they They had x-rayed her. And so he said, oh, you, I said, well, that's my daughter. And then that's when he told me that her neck was broken. And he said, well, we're going to have to send her to the medical center because we can't really handle it here. And, you know, I didn't really know what to do, what to think. All I could do is pray at the time. And I did. And I know she mentioned earlier about a network of friends. Keith Jones, the athletic trainer with the Houston Rockets, during that time, I'm like, what am I going to do? Who do I want the best? This is my baby daughter. This is my youngest daughter. Here she is laying up here with a broken neck, she, you know, and all kind of things are going through my head that she's going to be paralyzed. She's not going to be able to walk. I mean, she had such a bright future, but it was the grace of God. And I thought, I said, well, who do I need? I want the best for her. And I picked up my phone and I called Keith Jones. I said, Keith, I said, he said, what? I said, my daughter's in an accident. Her neck is broken. She may have possible spine fractures and stuff like that. I said, I need the best doctor that you know. He said, hey, I know a doctor named Parson. He said, matter of fact, I'm going to call him. And it just so happened, Dr. Parson, once she got to the medical center, parts of his team was there. And I was like, wow. And I'm like, it's crazy. But, you know, it's always good to have a network. And as athletic trainers, I'm quite sure all of us share some of the same experiences and some of the same battles, you know, we have to fight as far as dealing with the athletic administration and dealing with the coaches, you know. And everybody has a better idea of how we supposed to handle things, you know. But, you know, when I experienced that with my daughter, that really touched home, and it made me think. I'm like, man, I'd spent all of this time helping other people's kids get well, you know, relieving the pain and suffering of other people's children, and I couldn't even help my own. I really felt helpless. But, you know, through my spirit, God assured me. He restored that joy back in me, and that's where I get my strength. And that's the reason I said, Jeremy, that the joy of the Lord is my strength. You can't have strength from God unless you have joy, because the Bible tells us to, you count it all as joy. You know, a lot of times we experience things, and it's for a reason. Everything's for a reason. You know, my daughter was somewhat depressed during the summer. She was supposed to do her student teaching. She couldn't do that. She's recovering, and I had to explain it to her that, you know, everything has a season. I said, it just wasn't your season yet, you know, but she pulled through. I said, it could have been, you know, just perhaps just needed a little rest. And, you know, eventually she pulled out of her depression state, and she really started working hard to get back, and everything's fine. I mean, she's back driving. She's not afraid to drive anymore. So I give God the glory, and I give all thanks to him. Because it wasn't nothing that I did. It was him.
Incredible stories. And again, as athletic trainers, we're not alone. You have a network of friends, but then, as John's pointed out multiple times, the number one resource that he's gone to whenever he was faced with the situation of death, of somebody surviving, was he prayed. He went to God. His roots, his foundation of faith in Jesus Christ was the one thing that was able to strengthen him through the entire process and throughout his whole story as an athletic trainer. So just incredible stories. And John, I thank you so much for coming here today, for sharing your stories. And I look forward to hearing some more, you know, next time we meet, whether it's at GHATS or in ATA or SWAT or whatever, next time we cross, just hearing some more stories or just a hug.
It's my pleasure, Jeremy. It really is. And, you know, like I said, you know, to God be the glory. You know, because it's only through him, you know, through him. And through him, we can do all things, you know. So I just thank God that through my 37 years as an athletic trainer, you know, that he has been with me. He's guided me. He's you know, especially dealing with coaches, you know. When you tell these coaches, you know, that you have to deal with, but, you know, God, you know, he gives you that peace. He gives you that peace, and he makes you understand your purpose, You know, and I always recall what my mentor would always say, John Harvey. He would always, he said, well, hey, don't worry about it. Give thanks. And to this day, if I would call him and he's retired and I call him, hey, we have a conversation, he'll just say, take care and give thanks.
That's an excellent way to end, because this is National Athletic Training Month while we're recording this. And John, I want you to take a second and think about an athletic trainer you would like to thank. I know you mentioned a couple on your way, but I'm asking for one athletic trainer you would like to thank for helping to shape you just during National Athletic Training Month. We're recognizing athletic trainers and the way that they've shaped us into who we are. I'm going to start to give you a chance to think. Joe Martinez was an athletic trainer at Dobie High School my senior year. He has kind of been friends with me since then. I've hung out down at his house. He's met up with me at lots of different conventions and stuff like that. But he also showed more like a special interest and helped build a relationship. And so often we think of, how can this person help me? Well, Joe Martinez helped me by just being a friend. As a high school kid, you don't realize a lot of that. But as I've graduated college, as I become an adult, I realize how special that is to build that relationship and to be able to still maintain contact 15, 20 years after that initial one-year relationship is just really amazing. So Joe Martinez, thanks for helping to shape who I am as an athletic trainer and probably teaching me some things I shouldn't have learned, something like that. But so Joe Martinez. All right, John, an athletic trainer you would like to thank.
Well, really, Jeremy, I have really three. And number one, may he rest in peace, is Logan Wood, because he's the one that really steered me toward this profession. And of course, my college head trainer, John Harvey, which is my mentor, my friend, and Dr. Frank Walters, which is also my mentor and my friend. Both of those guys, I think, are they're just some awesome individuals. And both of them made me understand my purpose as an athletic trainer. You know, John Harvey was the type of guy, he would always say, man, you know, always be positive and just stay humble, stay humble. And Frank would always tell me, he said, hey, John, don't worry about that. Just do your job. Just do your job and take care of the athletes. And I want to give both of those guys a shout out, and I really appreciate them. And I thank God for allowing me, you know, to meet those two individuals, Frank Walters and John Harvey, because, people come in your life for a reason. Either they're going to be a blessing or a lesson. And I think both of those guys have been blessings to me and my career in athletic training.
All right, John, if somebody wants to contact you to maybe hear a little bit more about your story or to get your thoughts or opinion, maybe they're dealing with the situation similar, how can somebody contact you?
Well, they can just email me to my foundation's email. It's chaosproject@gmail.com. That's chaos is spelled CAEOS project, project, @gmail.com.
All right, can you tell me in like 2 minutes what Chaos Project is?
Chaos is a foundation that I started in conjunction with the John May Scholarship Endowment and the Research Education Foundation at in Dallas at the NATA. Chaos, it means creating access to educational opportunities through sports. And what Chaos is all about, what we do is that for about the last, since 2009, we have been doing sports performance camps and, how would you say, college fairs, you know, basically all over the world, specifically in the Asian Pacific with the Department of Defense schools. I take college and university coaches from all across the country, and we go, and what we do is that it gives the coaches an opportunity to sue a unique group of kids, you know. And what happened was is that, you know, we allow them to share information about their universities and stuff like that, because those kids that are lives on the military base, and their parents are you know, men and women in uniform, career, military, they don't get the same opportunities that kids stateside do. You know, and they participate in sports and stuff like that. But I tell the coaches when I try to recruit them to get them to come on board, I say nobody knew about Shaquille O'Neal or Michael Strahan, you know, until they got back stateside. And their parents were career military. You know, so it's an opportunity. And then plus, I tell the coaches, hey, this might be an opportunity for you to find a diamond in the rough. Because with the new post 9/11 GI Bill, the children can go to school on their parents' GI Bill. So it'll help you not only with your scholarship dollars, but it'll help that kid, you know, pursue his dream of playing, participating in athletics on a collegiate level. So that's basically what we do. We did a lot of venues here stateside with Demetrius Johnson Foundation in St. Louis. We did some things up in Dallas with a few of the players from the Dallas Cowboys. So we're on the move. And here lately, we just partnered with Eagle Wings Foundation. We've started a program. Specifically, it's a pilot program at Texas Southern University with Shadowing, along with the National Basketball Association retired players, of them shadowing and mentoring some of the college athletes. Because we try to make them understand that, hey, look, eventually your season's going to end. And when it ends, what you're going to do then? So you got to have a plan B, because, you know, not only you may be a basketball player or a football player, but in life, there's only three types of players: a lottery player, a checker player, and a chess player. A lottery player, you know, they're always wishing. They want to, you know, try to do it real quick. They want to win and get rich quick. A checker player, they're not too focused. They'll jump here and jump there. They'll move up, then they'll move back. And when they think they get a king, then they think that's the apex of the triangle till someone jumps them and takes their kingship. But a chess player, he always have a plan A, plan B, and a plan C. He focuses. He concentrates. He plans. And he don't really make a real hasty move. And he always thinking, you know, what if is in the equation. So that's what we try to instill in the college athletes, and that's what we're doing at this time. And hopefully in the very near future, we'll start promoting. We're going to try to pilot it, of course, over in A-Leaf ISD with the pilot program as far as, you know, promoting the scholarly athletes, you know, because everybody can't go to University of Texas and A&M and Florida and all that, especially if you're on the second or third string. But you are scholarly athletes. You have the grades. You have the SAT scores and all of that. But there's a lot of colleges and universities that have STEM funds. You know, you can use that. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to try to target those particular athletes in high school, coming out of high school, you know, the scholarly athletes, and say, hey, and we're going to identify those universities that have STEM money available and try to steer them toward those particular universities and colleges.
Sounds like you're a very busy man.
I try. I'm just a small pencil in the big hand of God, trying to get my name wrote on the Lamb books of life.
All right. Well, John, give you his email. Again, that's caeosproject@gmail.com. So you can find out more about the project, his foundation, or, again, like we discussed here, sudden cardiac arrest or dealing with an athlete with death or even a personal family issue, where his own daughter was trapped underneath the dashboard with a broken neck, and he couldn't do anything to help. Previous episodes where I've talked about sudden cardiac arrest and cardiac death was episode 135 and episode 190. If you want to check those out, but get a hold of John. Let an athletic trainer in your area know that you're there for them. Just say, hey, I'm here. I'm listening. If you need to talk, or hey, I know John has dealt with this. Once you, you know, can I give him your phone number to have him call you? That kind of thing. So reach out and don't just let them sit there and think that they're by themselves. So,
or Jeremy, they could just give me a call. at my foundation's number. It's 281-250-8772.
All right, so there you go. So you can give John an email or a call, the foundation email. Again, the phone number is 281-250-8772. I have that here in the show notes. This is sportsandmedicinebroadcast.com/John Mayes, J-O-H-N-M-A-Y-E-S. I have that email, the phone number in there. Also, I will be at the Frio Hydration booth, 2017 NATA convention, doing some interviews there. So come check me out. Come meet me. Say hi. Shake my hand. Jump on an interview. Bring somebody to interview. Maybe you have a speaker that you're friends with and you want to just, hey, come be a guest on the Sports Medicine Broadcast. Me and Jeremy will interview you, and you can run most of the show. So check that out. Look for me, find me, and I know it's going to be a good time hanging out with Rob because that's just the kind of guy he is. So, John, thank you so much for being here, for sharing your stories, for being open and encouraging, and then doing so much beyond of what you're just called to do. For Jeremy Jackson, host of the Sports Medicine Broadcast, my students here, John Mays, that's a wrap.